Hi and welcome to the Machine Ethics Podcast. In episode 90, we're joined by Wendell Wallach on the 25th of June 2024. We talk about the time before AI ethics was a thing and the things that academics were talking about, AGI skeptics, the possibility of a new ethic or ethos for human society, Wendell's trade-off ethics, capitalism and the AI oligopoly, the fact that ethics is hard, machine ethics, meditation and what I'm calling post-rational objective thought, and indeed consciousness. In this episode, we hit into some internet issues right near the end where we're talking about consciousness and machine consciousness and that sort of thing. So there are lots of edits at that point. So there's a real shame that we lost some of that thinking from Wendell, but hopefully we'll catch up with him at a later podcast. I also hadn't heard the term satisfice before, so I think I was using it slightly differently than intended, so do excuse my ignorance there. If you'd like to listen to more episodes, you can go to machine-ethics.net. You can also contact us at hello@machine-ethics.net. You can follow us on Twitter, machine_ethics, Instagram, Machine Ethics Podcast, YouTube, @machine-ethics. And if you can, you can support us on Patreon, patreon.com/machine-ethics. It was my absolute pleasure talking to Wendell in this episode, so I hope you enjoy. Wendell, thank you very much for joining me. If you could please introduce yourself, who you are, and what do you do?
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm what passes for an expert in the ethics and governance of emerging technologies. I have had many roles from a co-founder of the AI and Equality Initiative at the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs to chairing technology and ethics studies at the Yale Interdisciplinary Center for Bioethics. I could go on with that kind of thing, but it's boring as hell, I know. So we'll skip over it. But I've been, what shall I say, one of the earliest people in the world of machine ethics, AI ethics, the governance of AI, and actually emerging technologies more broadly. I did write a book called A Dangerous Master, How to Keep Technology from slipping beyond our control, that has just been republished with a new introduction by Sentient Publications just about a month ago. And that's really an introduction to emerging technologies, their science, ethics, and governance much more broadly. But in the context of your podcast, I'm probably best known for a book I co-authored with Colin Allen called Moral Machines, Teaching Robots Right from Wrong. And all of this goes back to a time when there was probably 100 of us in the world who cared about these issues. So we started mapping out, you know, what the concerns were, what the fields of interest would be. And ever since then, I've sort of been a gadfly trying to think of what's the next thing people are not looking at and tweaking them to begin to look at that. So now we have 10,000 people who think they are AI ethicists, and so just kind of keeping feeding them fodder for subject matter they should be grabbing onto.
Yeah, I actually started this podcast, and when I was thinking about a name, I thought machine ethics was a cool name, but I didn't realize was that it was actually a thing. And then I looked into it, and I found all this interesting stuff about what machine ethics was. And that then captivated me into like spending more time in the machine ethics sphere. But I think, like you were saying, there was in the early days, there's very few people like yourself. And I think we're probably going to dig into it a bit more later. But in the machine ethics world, there's still not that many people really. If you actually looking into, that sphere.
There are some AI people who are taking it more seriously. There are a lot of people who have talked about value alignment, which is kind of what the computer scientists like to think machine ethics is. But when push comes to shove, there's been very little work that has been done. And there are a few experiments now being formulated around how to create hybrid top-down and bottom-up approaches to AI having sensitivity to ethical considerations.
Yeah. So what we'll do, hopefully, is we'll just step back one step and then we'll dive back into machine ethics. So this is probably a ridiculous question, but what is AI?
Well, by now you've probably asked enough people that to know that there's not a great consensus around a definition. Though I think generally everybody thinks that AI is trying to reproduce or emulate human cognition within machines or human cognitive capabilities. But then you get into the thing of whether you're talking about narrowly just emulating or reproducing. Some people think they're reproducing. I think in most cases they're emulating because they aren't doing it quite the way humans do it. But, most AI is pretty narrow in the sense that it does one task or a few tasks that humans do, though the futurists, particularly those who believe in artificial general intelligence and artificial superintelligence, think that whether we're reproducing or emulating, we will have machines that far out exceed humans in all cognitive capabilities. I'm a bit of a friendly skeptic toward whether that's reasonable, but a friendly skeptic who recognizes that in terms of some human faculties, machines already exceed us.
Yeah. So do you think that you don't subscribe to the AGI possibility or the way that they are framing it, or that it's nearer than, you know, it's maybe further away than they think? That's, you know, how do you feel about that stuff?
Well, it's a very difficult problem, okay, where it is and who's correct. Obviously, the near-term people are the Ray Kurzweils who have it happening in this decade. And a lot of computer scientists want to say within 50 years in some of the earlier surveys. Mm. But with the onset of large language models, many people lowered that. But I think now that we're understanding the intrinsic problems of generative AI, I think that how far away that is going back up again in the minds of many computer scientists. I think the central problematic is, who believes that the mind and what the mind does can totally be reduced to a computational theory of mind and evolution? And if you add those two pieces together, so it's you will eventually get artificial general intelligence. And I think the skeptics are those like myself who say that is a somewhat too simplistic and materialistic or physicalistic, meaning kind of material science-based notion of what mind is and even what a human being is. So you presume you can emulate everything, but there are subtleties that are coming into play that are not reducible to either biochemistry or computational wiring and so forth. Yeah. But that said, I think all of us have been surprised at how much apparent intelligence you get out of systems that are just playing with language, for example. I think we are coming to understand that there's much more that we recognize as intelligence that's intrinsic to the very language we use. But then when a language model starts to do something very stupid, you understand that, yes, some of that intelligence is intrinsic to language itself. Others is just in a totally different realm of reasoning or cognition.
Do you think it's almost easy this is a semantic issue, isn't it? But do you think it's more useful to actually just change that intelligence piece and use the kind of like branding term smarts or something like that, something less anthropomorphic? So it's like artificial smarts because it's doing interesting things which are helpful and are, you know, more or less narrow. Maybe it's, you know, the LLMs are less narrow, obviously. But the intelligence piece is it confuses things, maybe.
Well, I think it's very unfortunate that we have this term artificial intelligence, and you can blame it on John McCarthy and this invitation he had to what we now think of as the fathers of artificial intelligence, who gathered for a summer for a workshop at Dartmouth in 1956. But I think it also points to the naivete of what computer scientists think they are doing and how easy they think it is to create. So back then, they thought that within a decade, we would have machines that could beat grandmasters at chess and would communicate in natural language, you know. And we didn't beat Garry Kasparov, you know, for another 36 years or something like that. They actually assigned vision to one graduate student that summer, and we really haven't fully solved the vision. The vision problem of artificial intelligence. So, I mean, we've seen this over and over again. We've gone through cycles after cycles in the last 68 years now, that where almost nothing happens, and there's some breakthrough, and everybody thinks, well, it's all around the corner. And, you know, the latest, of course, is generative AI. But to say that is not to say that generative AI hasn't opened up fascinating frontiers for AI. I mean, my particular ballywick for decades has been emphasizing what could go wrong. And I'm not emphasizing what could go wrong in the form of being a dismisser. I'm just saying, yes, but this is also on the table. And if you don't direct attention to deep fakes, scams, whatever you want to talk about today, you will not really ever get around to realizing what you think is the potential. Mm-hmm. Now, what is the potential? We don't know that. We don't. Even if artificial general intelligence is not on the table, the potential of humans adding that extra bit of magic that we can bring to the table together with artificial intelligence does perhaps open up at least a universe of what can be understood scientifically or computationally.
Yeah, so that you can be applied in lots of different fields and push us further into things that we want to do, I guess.
Yep.
So I noticed that on your website it says you might be working on a new book called Cloud Illusions, Self-Understanding and Ethical Decision-Making for the Information Age. And I wondered if part of that was you trying to assert whether we need a new type of ethics or a new type of thinking behind how we deal with this stuff. Is that the case?
Yeah, it is. And I can give it a little broader framing, which is what it has now. It has a broader framing.
Right.
But I think we need a new ethos, you know, call it Enlightenment 3.0 or whatever you want to. I think we're at a critical juncture in human history. And the kinds of challenges that we're confronting, such as artificial intelligence, but climate change, there's all kinds of things that we're confronting that we don't really have the right tools to deal with it. And I have been, what shall I say, trying to create what I think are elements of that ethos. So my focus it's now broken down into three books, and I'm trying to make it clipped. One is moral intelligence in the digital age. The second is self-understanding in the digital age. And the third is meaning in the digital age. And I've been in the ethics world for a long time, long enough to know not only are people stupid about ethics, but we don't have the right way of even talking about it. So I don't look at ethics as the application of a process or tools per se or values per se. I look at ethics as that part of life where we're trying to navigate uncertainties. and the fact that many of our make difficult decisions, and many of our challenges are decisions where a confluence of values impinge upon them, where we don't always have the information we need or can't predict the consequences of our action. So I look at ethics in terms of how are we going to navigate that, and that the ethical systems that have been created were largely attempts to help navigate that. Now, the first of the ethical systems were largely about rules and duties. But when you think about that, that's really about thinking fast and slow. How do you have a quick response to a challenge at hand? And a quick response may be necessary for survival or because there's no time. Now, but in what we're dealing with ethical challenges are those that really require, they're devilishly difficult, require a lot of attention, a lot of work. Some of them are no easier than solving the dark matter, dark energy problem in physics. You know,
these wow, yeah.
And they really require a whole community working on them. And they require new tools. And the two new tools that I'm adding to the nomenclature are what I call trade-off ethics and what I call a silent ethic. And a silent ethic is more about human moral psychology. And it obviously plays into things that have come up in meditation and sports medicine and all kinds of things about one's relationship to one's inner states of mind and thought and thinking. But trade-off ethics, and that's easier for people who've been submersed in those worlds for years to understand, harder for people who have never meditated, for example.
Can I say something pithy? It sounds like marriage ethics, doesn't it? Trade-off ethics, compromise?
It's not marriage ethics, but obviously marriage, you have to learn about trade-offs.
Exactly, yeah.
But trade-off ethics is more the reason part of it, and the silent ethic is more the moral psychology. And these are both separate, but they can be seen as complementary. Trade-off ethics is just saying that when you have multiple courses of action, don't look at only the benefits, but what the trade-offs are. So what the price is for each of those courses of action. And if you don't address both the downside as you make your choice, you have not made an ethical choice. So it's basically, slamming simple consequentialism, but I'm not... A good consequentialist would say, we also have to look at the bad consequences. Yep. But the fact is that's never been intrinsic to consequentialism or utilitarianism.
Does it involve a certain amount of prior, like information about the environment or the system that you're working within? You probably haven't answered this, but we live in quite a complex, interconnected situation. So does that trade-off... just work with the knowns or the information at hand, essentially?
Well, you can only work with the knowns, but you can also look at the unknowns and whether the knowns are what doesn't play out. So my assumption is, I do some empirical work, and my assumption is that if I introduce this form of AI, the people who will lose their jobs are X, Y, and Z, and this percentage of them will be in North America, and that percentage will be in Africa, and so forth. So we can do that empirical analysis, but we're in a universe of unknowns and probabilities. So it's not enough to just tag the knowns. It's also very important to look at what might be the high impact but low probability outcomes.
Yep.
But it all is still navigating in a world of unknowns, of uncertainties, and it's all, a recognition which has become axiomatic for people who have thought about ethics, which is you can't fully control the results of any action, So all of that is all of that a part of moral intelligence, but it just says if you're really going to make good decisions, there's a lot of work in it. And it may be, and in some of these areas, needs collective participation from those people who who can navigate or have expertise in different facets. Yep. And in some situations, it needs input from a public, even if the public's response may be naive or conservative. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you talk about, you know, tinkering with the human genome, for example, you know, you will probably get responses don't fully understand what we're talking about in terms of the genetics, but they also do say there's certain outcomes we're very uncomfortable with. And and we think the pursuit of those because they serve the advantage of a few individuals, but maybe to the detriment of a large percentage of society, really cannot be just ignored. You know, that has to be part of your conversation. Now, whether that conversation, you know, goes through a worldwide ban on some technologies, or whether that conversation goes into the regulation of technologies, or whether that conversation goes into, you know, those who want to experiment on these areas understand you have this responsibility in your experimentation.
I guess it behooves us to think about this stuff, and it feels like when I've been talking to organizations, you might have a framework or way of working that you can apply to, let's say, the data science pipeline. So you're making a thing, let's think about the stakeholders and the ethics of using someone's data in a certain way and all this sort of stuff. But at a macro level, it doesn't really tell you whether it's what you're doing is good in of itself, in a way that we need something to happen there. And I think if I can bring it back to one of your pieces, you wrote a paper about this governance piece, right? So I think there's this idea that maybe there's too many actors doing things on their own and we need to like play together, essentially.
Well, whether we're going to actually play together or whether we need at least some international governance to moderate, to have deeper conversations. I mean, my problem is, I think in nearly all situations, the actors are incredibly naive and few of them recognize that. So, you know, so I brought together workshops where I brought many of the leaders in AI together with the leaders in philosophy and machine ethics and other things. And these were the first time these people had, you know, had encountered each other. And I found that at least the computer scientists were amazingly cavalier about dismissing ethics and what little ethicists knew. Mm-hmm. And amazingly presumptuous about how they could throw out a term like value alignment and really understand what the hell they were saying. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like, oh, we can give you a rather bland term, apply it to the problem we want to solve, which for many of them was superintelligence. Right. And if we can just align the machine's values with human values, everything is fine. But it's clear that everybody who's actually took that problem seriously finds very soon that they're in the world of ethics. And it's very clear that good ethicists, people who think deeply about any problem, even a small one, come to understand how quickly, particularly with technologies, that these are socio-technical artifacts. I mean, they're sitting on the fringe of what technology can do and what's going on in human society, and the two are shaping each other. And you get into this exponential growth of consequences that nobody could ever fathom. But it's nice to start with with a group of people who have a deep sense of where the problematics lie, where the where social factors are going to determine more about the implementation of the technology. I mean, right now, social factors are basically the technologies. AI is in the control of a digital oligopoly, whose primary obligation is to its shareholders.
Yeah.
And it's primary about making money. You know, that's, you know, so that doesn't mean we're developing good AI or we're putting adequate investments in good AI or quelling the downside. And that oligopoly knows that some of the regulations that should be put in place are not in their interest. And they'll do everything they can to quell it. And it's not that hard because our governance structures have corporate capture. Mm. The corporations just tell the legislatures, well, this is very complicated and you don't fully understand it. So so leave it to us. And by the way, here's $100,000 toward your reelection campaign.
Nice. Is that society's issue that we need to sort out? Is that who does that come down to? Because for me, we live in this capitalist situation, and when you consider the shareholder piece and that we're not making whatever it is, in this case AI products, for you know, for cash, for money, you might be a public organization, you might be making the AI systems to help healthcare, whatever it is. That's a very different kind of environment to be thinking and creating in. So I was just wondering if the capitalist situation is probably getting in the way of maybe better outcomes for the general social future, I guess.
Right. Well, that's a great question. You know, I think you know what a great question is. That's what I'm asking you. And there's obviously those people who have a simplistic answer. The problem with capitalism is that capitalism has been productive, and that in certain legal structures, capitalism helped us find a way to innovate, to have corporations and limit liability so that people could experiment. And we got the Industrial Revolution, we got the germ theory revolution in medicine, and we got the sanitation revolution in public services and so forth. I mean, there's a lot of good there. So, but I think capitalism has gone askew, and particularly in America. And, somewhere in history, like in the 1920s, there was, you know, the growth of the labor movements and so forth. Mm-hmm. And they established some countervailing power. Which was kind of a good thing. But I think what's happened, and we can all look at different historical antecedents as to what went wrong with capitalism. But today we have capitalism where basically all productivity gains go to a small class of people. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there is no obligation. And I don't care how many billions Bill Gates has given to taxes.
Yeah.
It doesn't alter the fact that he's in a class of people who none of us are. Now, I'm not in that class of people, but I can own a few pieces of stock, you know, so I am an owner of capital, which is, you know, but the fact is I own a minuscule amount of stock compared to what the 1%. Mm. And I think that's how that happened. I don't know, but we have I can go through a historical analysis of where I think the critical elements are. There are clearly economists out there who can do a much better job than I can on that. But it's clear that capitalism has gone wrong, and we have political economies that are controlled by the capitalist in ways that that were only speculated at the turn of the 19th century, when we would write books, we would have books, you know, like The Ruling Elite and so forth. So that's a real problem. The real problem is, it's both how do you get a society's value structure realigned, what serves more the collective good better, and then how do you get that implemented in government? The nice thing is that you see a Bill Gates and a Warren Buffett, come around and say, well, now that I've made all this money, what should happen to it? And, you know, in some cases, you know, they're doing good, whether it fully compensates for the role that they played in feeding a capitalist system that that is out of whack, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. I think there's a lot that I could say here, but then it becomes a capitalist podcast and our social futures podcast instead of a AI ethics one. So I was really
we'll have that podcast at another time.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But thank you. I stopped you during when you were saying that kind of this dual ethic that we were talking about earlier about this compromise piece, utilitarian compromise.
Well, I called it trade-off ethics.
Trade-off, yes, yeah.
But since utilitarianism is the aspect of ethics that looks at, looks at alternative pathways and picks the greatest good for the greatest number, that means, depending on your definition of that, it seems like utilitarianism. But, you know, I'm not a utilitarianist in the sense that I think that utilitarianism is the end all and be all of ethics.
Yeah.
So I actually think that the greatest good is also intrinsically entangled in certain deontological principles.
Right, right. What you were saying with when you were making this assessment, right, this ethical assessment, at that point you have like these probabilities, this may or may not happen, this is a bit unknown, this is very much known, and you can lay it all out. At that point, could you then say, let's be a utilitarian about this now, or let's use virtue ethics and say all these things are wrong because of they're not striving for, you know, a virtuous person? Or you could use your other reciprocal part of your ethic that you were going to talk about as well, which we haven't gotten to yet.
What I call the silent ethic.
Yes, exactly.
So, I mean, I'm saying ethical decision making is tough. It's hard.
Yeah.
And we're trying to make it easy. We try to reduce it to thinking fast, to what we can react to, what our habits are, and so forth. And that's not solving hard ones. And when you really look at some hard problems, conscientism in its present form is inadequate, deontological systems are inadequate, virtue ethics is inadequate. Mm. You know, but all of those have certain truth to those. All those are languages that we use to work through. And if you can bring all of those into play in an intelligent form, then maybe collectively we can work through some of these challenges that aren't, you know, just personal problems, but these are really collective issues that that we as a society have to do. But some very interesting things come into play. When I've tried to look at the different courses of action and what might be the trade-offs of each of those courses of action, and then I've looked at what can we address? We can't address everything on the downsides. We don't even know what it all, you know, what it's all going to be. I find that actually, oftentimes the net benefit between one and the other is not so great.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
You know, and you know, I'm not ready to say that that's an intrinsic. You know, I mean, that would be like an ontology that would say nothing you do makes any difference.
Right.
You know, I'm not ready to go to that, but I think it is true in many cases. A lot of the most attractive courses of action don't look very attractive once you look at the downside. So I think that eliminates the worst of them. You know, that kind of analysis can eliminate the worst of them, because you just say, you know, you can see that, you know, humanity doesn't want a course of action that's going to eliminate three quarters of it. You know, I mean, just to be absurd here for a moment. And you get down to a few courses of action, and then the question is, well, which of those are we going to go with?
Yeah.
And here's where I think ethics does get into virtue ethics, and it does get into a realm where for somebody who has worked through that, certain kinds of feelings or mental states start to indicate you're getting closer to the best of these actions, you know, the best of these. And you may not fully know why, but for whatever reason, you feel that it's probably the best course of action, or you've looked at what, you've even looked at whether, well, you know, I sometimes say I'm a racist. I'm not trying to be saying that. They say I'm a racist because I get into a lot of situations where I just favor minorities over white people.
Right, yeah.
So I look at that and say, okay, did you go with B because you're a racist? You know?
Yeah.
I'm afraid that piece is just going to get cut, and if somebody wants to write someday, they'll have a deep fake and they'll destroy me. Luckily, I don't have that kind of power, so nobody needs to destroy me.
You'll get cancelled by some sort of clan. I mean, that's or something.
I mean, you have, in other words, that's where virtue ethics come in. That's where self-understanding comes in. You know enough about yourself to understand what are your strong prejudices. You then look at your feelings in that regard, and then you see what you're left with. And I think your feelings still are pretty good. And it's not just feelings. Mm. There's a certain point you get to. And again, if you haven't meditated for a long time or done this kind of, people don't understand this. You get to where you're just quiet. You don't need to think about this sucker anymore, you know? Yeah. And for whatever reason, when I go with A, I got to think much more about my prejudices. When I go with B, I'm just quiet.
Mm.
You know, I know that I'm in the right place at the right time in the right way.
It feels like you could post hoc justify that, couldn't you? You could say, you know, imagine a politician coming out and going, we've decided the best course of action is this because it felt good. You know what I mean? That would be...
Well, that's been the problem with satisficing. You know, it just felt good.
Yes,
felt
right.
Good. Felt good means something if you've done the work. Felt good means absolutely nothing if you haven't done the work.
Right.
You know, and I think there will be post hoc. I think there'll be post hoc justification even when you're right.
Mm.
What's interesting to me about the silent ethic and what I think is revolutionary in what I'm saying, in the sense that I don't know anybody else who said it, is that I think in your decision-making process, if you have a degree of self-awareness and a relationship to your thought and thinking and mental processes and so forth, when you look at various options and you don't know what to do, you should go with the one that makes you feel relatively quieter, less thinking, less, you know, there's a dropping away of having to go over this territory again. So the problem with spirituality and meditation and all these things is they have made inner quiet a goal, because inner quiet is understood to be energizing, you know, a doorway to altered states of mind, you know. So they make that a goal. The problem is if you make it a goal, then you're repressing thought and thinking and emotions because they get in the way of that, the goal. This is actually looking at that from the total other way around.
Right.
There's no problem with the goal, but it's the byproduct of your decision-making process. And if you don't understand it as the byproduct of your decision-making process, then you will be satisficed. You will be satisficed with something that is short of your best efforts.
So if you relate that back to meditation, could you satisfice in working through your mind is thinking about to the point where you are satisficed, you are calm because you worked through those different thoughts, and you are become quiet because
you are calm, naturally calm, as opposed to be satisficed. Satisficed basically says you can only think of, you know, a limited number of options, and therefore right. we go with the one that we feel most comfortable with. So I'm saying that, well, that may be partially true, but that doesn't get you the full distance, and certainly not when we're talking about some of these big problems.
Yeah,
I think it also requires a certain kind of trust of what the subconscious mind is doing, which gets us in a whole other territory that I still haven't fully written about, and I'm not sure that many other people see it in the way I do.
Yeah.
But the point is that if you have a degree of self-understanding, and you know pretty much when your ego's active and when you're just quiet, you know, then you can work with that. Then you can work with, okay, there's still too much Wendell in this. This is still too much. This is about me and what
yes,
I have.
Right.
Something like that, but I'm not really quiet. And that requires a degree of work, effort, you know, so that's where virtue ethics comes into being. That's where spirituality comes into being. And it doesn't rule out that you go to warfare or anything like that. It's just, you have to see that, well, that's who I am and where I stand, which is basically Krishna's argument with Arjuna. So that's who you are.
Right.
These may be your cousins and you don't want to go to war, but that's your dharma. Now, I can raise questions about, you know, that kind of dharma or whether that's really what Krishna was saying, but he happens to be saying it in the context of a war, and Arjuna happens to be a warrior. But the point is, virtue ethics has always had courage and, other virtues mixed in there. I look at it a little bit differently. I think each of us is a nexus of consciousness and a sea of relationships. And I'm here, you're there. And you being there has a whole confluence of history and what functions you've taken on and what responsibilities you have and what you've learned about yourself and same here. And it's not the same. And we aren't in the same space.
Mm.
We may be able to subsume each other's space for a moment or something and have a conversation like this.
Yeah.
But it's still that we are in a sea of relationships where we're all fulfilling various functions in this vast planetary cosmos that we're collectively in, not to mention
what goes on
beyond. I mean, I think there's a reason you've done this many podcasts. You see that you're fulfilling a certain kind of need, and somehow that's who you are. You're interested in these questions that you think need to be probed more deeply, and you feel that if you can probe them more deeply, or if you can present to your listeners people who have probed them more deeply, it may only be, we may have only moved one sand, but we've moved one grain of sand in our collective ability to appreciate the challenge of the day is.
And I'm hoping, as I hope the listeners are taking this in, taking this on board. Thank you so much. I realized that we don't have that much time left. So if you will indulge me, what I wanted it, because I was trying to make a list of things that you touch on, you're interested in, maybe you've written again and again on. And one of the last things, there's obviously more you can say about machine ethics stuff. I wanted to hit on the consciousness aspect because I thought that was both sticky and also you have an opinion, you've written stuff. So I was interested in the idea of machine consciousness, whether we can talk about AMAs, like artificial moral agents, and whether they are inherently conscious or need to be, or vice versa, whether consciousness demands some sort of morality embedded. Even if it's just a one-liner on that, that'd be great.
Well, I mean, I can say a lot here.
Yes, actually. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I'm going to make a few presumptions in this conversation. I'm going to presume that you and most listeners to this understand that there is a massive field of consciousness studies now. And though it tends to embrace a certain degree of skepticism, whether we know what we're talking about, because it's sometimes called toward a science of consciousness, recognizing that there are a lot of problematics. And a lot of what it's done is got into trying to define terms and recognizing the differences on how people are using words like consciousness. So some of the problem is, well, what is consciousness, and to what extent is it unique to humans or vertebrates or, you know, other animals? There's certainly aspects of consciousness or how it's evolved that we apply that we don't see much of, you know, in other animals. And the difficulty, again, is what's innate and what emerged over time. So when we're talking about consciousness, are we talking about an innate faculty and innate to who? Some people like Harnad think it's innate to any animal that can feel. I recently was looking again at a breakdown of the origins of consciousness and the breakdown of the bicameral mind, which was a bestseller in the 60s. And it's basically an argument that consciousness emerged. It emerged in humans about 3,000 years ago. And that the bicameral mind, referring to the two lobes of the brain, was pre-conscious humans. Humans who are aware of being conscious largely functioned as if they were having auditory hallucinations and the gods and their ancestors were speaking in their ear, telling them what to do. And that thesis says that the Homerian Iliad is really a pre-conscious document, a consciousness, a document about a pre-conscious civilization. So I don't want to get too caught up in all that, but I think it's a question very much of what definition of consciousness we're talking about. And I tend to think there is something about consciousness that is intrinsic to the very universe we're moving in. That's a panpsychist viewpoint. But it still isn't really what we talk about as consciousness until it's apprehended by a body that feels and observes and reflects. So I'm willing to grant consciousness to a vast array, of creatures. But I also said there's always something in consciousness that is evolutionary. Now, when you get into a dualistic system, basically, Buddhism is there's this pure consciousness that as a idealistic system, it says all of matter has emerged from that. I can feel you want me to move along.
No, it's fine.
So I think consciousness is and will remain a great mystery as to what is really consciousness. If that could all be elucidated, could it be realized in computational systems? In theory, yes. In principle, it would be damn hard. But it doesn't matter because the science isn't there yet. So my own view is the consciousness does something. It does something because of the way it's entangled in human actors. And it's not just outside of the human system. I'm not using that word. But it's doing subtle things, and it's being interacted with by subtle brains that are more comprehensive in their relationship to consciousness than I believe we're going to get with machines in any foreseeable future.
There's almost two problems there. There's one, we don't really know what consciousness is, and therefore it's hard to attribute it. And secondly, it's probably much more complicated than we could possibly design or have like a in your one of your machine moral machines sections, there's this idea of emergence, and that would it feels far-fetched to allow things to, or design things to emerge.
Well, you understand that in moral machines, we got Stan Franklin. And Stan Franklin had a theory of consciousness, and he had a theory of machine consciousness that was based on Bernie Barr's global ethics, global consciousness theory, global workspace theory. So that was kind of a pragmatic relationship to consciousness. We took Stan up on that and worked together with him and produced some papers. And the next to the last machine model we developed together with him. The Superintelligence Project presumes that we're going to have smarter than humans in all respects, you know, and the project a little bit more bottom up, kind of saying, well, when you get what we refer to as functionally ethical systems, then how are they going to recognize the ethical significance of problems they encounter and factor through the best decision? That's very different than, you know, that's kind of just, you know, how do you ensure that your autonomous system, which has been given this task, like taking care of or being the companion for a human in their home, how does it deal with the ethical challenges that will come up in that? And, you know, how do you deal with climate change or the inequality of political economies and so forth? So we weren't looking at a model that was going to solve all problems. We were looking at a model that could just help people think about this from the bottom up. And Bernie Barrs and Stan Franklin called this, you know, a theory. Well, first Bernie Barrs with global workspace theory called this kind of a theory of consciousness. But I mean, I've been meditating for 50 years, and I could probably say that anybody who meditated for that long has apprehended things about mental states and their own consciousness that just seem to defy this simple computational model of what consciousness is. Now, that said, Tononi has a model of consciousness that perhaps could be implemented. You know, there are certainly models of consciousness such as, like generative AI, that get us further down the road than we thought we could get computationally.
Yes, but it would be a version of consciousness which is called X, Y, and Z, and it's going in this direction instead of going in this other direction, maybe.
Right, and I just think it needs the complementarity of wise human beings to deal with these more complex issues. So when I'm saying we deal with complex issues, I'm not ruling out a role for computer systems. Yep. I'm just saying that we need, you know, just as these are collective problems where we need many kinds of people at the table. For example, if we were going to come up with a full new ethos, I'd want economists at the table, just for an example. So I might be an ethicist who is more comprehensive than narrow in focus, but you know, some of those problems are going to need the more narrow focused person who is aware that this particular problem is much more nuanced than is naturally thought. I've attended hundreds of lectures, if not thousands, on different ethical problems, you know, enhancements and, you know, bioethical issues on end of life. And every time I go into this lecture, I think I know what the core issue is. And then the lecturer says, well, if you look at this from a deontological perspective, there's this and this and this. If you look at it from a virtue ethics perspective, there's also this. And I've come to see these as just languages of ethics, you know, and simplistically, even those of us who try to be more comprehensive thinkers tend to have, I won't say a superficial understanding, because we're often aware of things that others wouldn't be, but in many subjects, we don't have, you know, great depth. When you're a human is intelligent, you kind of understand what you don't understand, you know, and you sort of know what the next question is beyond your level of understanding.
I feel like that's a constant thing with age for me, just the knowing more and knowing that I don't know so much more.
Yeah. It's a great paradox.
Yes, exactly. It's a paradox. So the last question we normally ask is around something that you might have already mentioned, but what excites you and what scares you or cause you pause in this kind of AI techno-social future that we're creating?
So that's a good question, and one I often ask in podcasts. The last question.
Right.
Yeah, so it's I mean, first, let me thank you, because I think this has been a wonderful discussion. And I always feel that discussion is revealing of the intelligence of the person I'm interacting with. And we've gotten into some fascinating corners together.
Thank you. That's very gracious.
My concern is that we will never get a handle on managing these technologies, and they're going to be applied willy-nilly, and they're going to be applied in ways that serve the interests of small elites at the expense of humanity as a whole. And so it's not like I sit here fearful of artificial superintelligence. I'm less concerned with artificial and superintelligence than forms of intelligence that humans attribute more intelligence to than the systems really have, and therefore they put them in positions of making critical decisions. Totally naive about some of the high impact, low probability decisions or actions that these systems could take. So that's the AI part of it. And that I don't see anything in the form of either will or governance yet that makes me feel that we're really going to get a handle on this. And I'm not sure that that is even likely to happen until we have some relatively major tragedy. I hope it's not too tragic, where humanity begins to demand that of their legislators. So that's on the AI side, but it's not just AI, it's biotechnologies, it's nanotechnologies, it's geoengineering.
Yeah.
It's a whole plethora of new technologies we're dealing with. So my basic sense is we're on the wrong trajectory at the moment. And that trajectory is dominated by corporate interest, and the focus is largely the replacement of human labor and surveillance, and nudging us onto a more satisfactory trajectory is a difficult task. But what I do is I'm looking for what I call the salt march moments, which refers to something during Gandhi's career, where a little action actually had quite an impact in nudging the trajectory that humanity was on, and that in that case that India and England were on. So I look at the salt march moments, where through sometimes something very subtle, we could nudge the trajectory just a little bit, and therefore our destination would be radically different than where it would have been otherwise. But I'm not sure that what's taking place is our collective intelligence at the moment. I'm concerned that our tendency to be stupid, our tendency, human stupidity could prevail. And human stupidity, I'm afraid, is going to prevail, at least in one form, in attributing more intelligence to computational systems than they have.
Right. So on that bleak note, I'm grasping here. I kind of want to leave on a positive note. Do you think there's a? I mean, you obviously talked about the fact there are positive things that AI can do and achieve.
The positive note is pretty simple. I mean, I am not a naysayer. I'm not an anti-science person. I'm not a person who wants to shut down these technologies. I think we can realize all the potential there, but we do need to muster a little bit of will and intention toward managing these technologies, and a willingness to cooperate more broadly than individuals and nations seem to be demonstrating that they will do at the moment. My hope is that there will be salt march moments in the coming years that will write that trajectory. But I have no doubt that we can do it. I'm just, the pessimistic side is only we don't seem to be doing it now.
Yeah. Well, thank you again for your time. This is absolutely fascinating. And like I said before, it's been a real joy for me because I've been looking at your stuff for a while now, and you've been on my list for a very long time. So thank you. Hopefully, let us know when your latest books are out, and maybe we will pick those up and check those out. How do people follow you, read your stuff, contact you, all that sort of thing?
CarnegieCouncil.org is where we've been running the AI and Equality Initiative. We're reflecting, though, whether that's going to end or not. But a lot of my editorial content, articles we have developed together with other leading thinkers on the governance of AI, they're all on that website. There's a podcast about many topics that we didn't talk here that was just done a couple weeks ago that is of me on that website. There's podcasts I do. My closest colleague is Anya Cass-Pearson, and her writing and podcasts are there also. So CarnegieCouncil.org is a good place to go, but a lot of material is now showing up on Sentient publications also. I think they're .org, and they have various other podcasts, lectures, panels about my latest book, or the latest edition of my A Dangerous Master on that website.
Thank you very much for your time, and hopefully we'll speak to you again.
Thank you. I truly enjoyed this and look forward to our meeting in person one day.
Thank you. Welcome to the end of the podcast. Thanks again for Wendell for joining us. I definitely hope to get him on again in the future. Like I keep saying, it was just awesome to have him on and talk about all these different subjects and get his opinion, as I've been reading his stuff and people associated with him for Neon 7 to 8 years now. I really like his idea of the two ethics he brought forward, the trade-off ethics, and the other one, which is more kind of the meditative human side or human experience side. I'm personally not 100% kind of subscribing to that aspect of or this kind of objectivity of experience becoming part of that decision-making process. For me personally, it feels a little bit fuzzy, but maybe with a few meditations I could come around. I also massively agree with the thrust of his argument that we are heading towards this need or this kind of evolution of this ethic or ethos that we need to pull into the digital realm, that we need to kind of think about these things slightly differently and maybe consolidate or push forward in a new way. It feels like a pertinent thing that we should be doing, hopefully doing more together as well, as Wendell pointed out. Thanks again for joining us. If you can, you can support us on Patreon, patreon.com/machineethics, and I'll see you next time.